It's pledge season on Slate Podcasts. If you love Mom and Dad Are Fighting, you can help support it by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/fightingplus. We'll be talking about it more later in the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, September 21st, the Emotional Bloodshed edition. I'm Gabriel Roth, an editor at Slate, and the father of Eliza, age 6, and Leo, who is 3.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, a podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 16, Teddy, who is 14, and a stepdaughter, Lily, who is 17.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and editor in Oakland, California, and I am the father to Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 14.
Today on our show, we have a question from a listener who is having playdate problems and another who just found out that her husband is paying his grown son's rent. Plus, as always, we will have triumphs and fails. We'll have recommendations. On Slate Plus, Slate editor-in-chief Julia Turner will relate a catastrophic parenting fail involving two boys, a wedding, and a missing piece of cake. Let's start with triumphs and fails. Rebecca, triumph or fail today?
I've got a fail. And there's a little bit of background. I won't take too long filling you in. On Sunday night, not atypical these days, I went to bed along with Kevin before my son Henry went to bed because he was up studying. He is now taking 4 AP classes. And as it turns out, that's a ton of work. So he was up studying late. We had had like a weird night with Teddy where Teddy had been really upset about something. So I encouraged him to go to bed early and it was sort of stressful. And I'm comfortable going to bed after before my sons go to bed, especially on the weekends. And it kind of happens during the week sometimes. I've gotten more comfortable with it. I don't think they're going to get kidnapped or whatever at this point. So I wake up Monday morning at a little bit late, like 6:40. Usually I try to get up around 6:30. Grab the dogs, take the dogs out for a walk, get back to the house about 5 of 7. The routine is that the boys usually head off to school around 7:30 or shortly thereafter. Henry drives them both to school now. I come back in the house, let the dogs off the leash, look at the clock, kind of panic, look in the fridge, see if there's stuff to make Teddy a sandwich. Kevin's like running, run to wake Kevin up, run upstairs, because I realize I don't hear the kids. I think maybe they slept in, and they're gone. They're just like totally gone. Their beds are empty, unmade. Maybe they're in the basement. Maybe they went downstairs. Maybe they got up early and they're like hanging out and playing pool or something. I run all the way down to the basement. They're gone. They're just not here. And I have no idea where they are. So I text Henry. And I'm like, where are you? And I text Teddy and I'm like, where are you? And Henry, about a lazy 8-9 minutes later, texts me back and is like, oh, yeah, we decided to leave a little early this morning. And I was like, okay, well, next time leave me a note. And I'm trying to like calm down. My heart is pounding. And I realized, like, I'm at a point right now where I could have like no idea like where the fuck my kids are. I had no idea where they were. I have not in any way set up like an infrastructure plan for like, hey, if you're just not going to be here in the morning when I get up, let me know, because this just never happened before. I lost my kids. I lost my almost grown ass teenage kids. First thing in the morning, they managed to stealthily get out of the house without me. Now, the upside of this is that, Henry's official story is that he hadn't finished some of his schoolwork and one of the books he needed was at school. So he wanted to get to school early so he could work on it. But what I found out actually happened was that he knew Teddy was really upset and thought it would be nice for the two of them to grab a coffee or whatever, some breakfast at the little local cafe. So they did that on their way to school just so that Henry could have a few minutes to talk to his brother. But he still needs to leave a note, right? So that the next time I don't lose my two children first thing in the morning. But yeah, I had gotten up, did my whole routine without even knowing they were gone. And they were, in fact, gone.
This is a triumph disguised as a fail. I'm sorry.
I don't know about that.
I can understand your anxiety. I can understand wanting to know where they are in a geographical sense. But at the same time, like if my kids could somehow leave the house and get to school without me,
it'll happen.
That is a breathtaking triumph, and you should be proud. And the fact that the reason that they left early was so that one son could be compassionate and sympathetic to the others. I mean, this is just a triumph all around.
I know. What are you talking about? This is like the most amazing thing ever.
Yes, but I did not. Okay, so this is a maybe a personal failure. I was outside. where Henry's car is usually parked. It was not there. I didn't notice. Like, I'm so locked in, you know, and I granted, I'm not saying there's anything like wrong with me. It just kind of happened. And I'm, you know, but it felt in the moment like things are so always insane, just trying to get stuff done, like do this, do this, do this, do this, that I actually didn't notice that my kids were not home at a time that they are 100% of the time always home. So yeah.
Okay,
that's where the panic came from.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from. But again, like, this is so cool that your kids are basically doing what it is that we've been training them to do for all these years. This is mm-hmm. the whole point. Everything from the first diaper change, you know, it all leads up to this moment where the kids can take responsibility for themselves and for one another in this story.
And
this
you've
is
become,
amazing.
You've become completely redundant. You've yes. successfully yes, this, made yourself useless.
Yeah, you,
bravo.
Yes, you've basically downsized yourself out of a job.
Yeah, I mean, that is the goal, and I agree. And I was the one thing I was thrilled about was to hear that Teddy had somehow like cobbled a lunch together, because that is like the one thing that I mean, Henry has been a self-starter like forever. But Teddy, I'm always just like checklisting with him, because he's a lot like Ezra. Like, he will just leave without his stuff for practice after school. He'll just do that. So as it turns out, maybe checklisting has been enabling, because this morning, guess what? He made his own damn lunch. So yeah, I'm thinking maybe I can go for longer walks with the dogs in the morning from now on.
Cut to Teddy in the lunchroom opening his lunch, and inside is just like a huge stack of ham and yeah. three donuts.
Yeah.
And a bag of Doritos.
Yeah. Takes it out very happily, puts it on a tray.
Yeah.
All right. Congratulations on that fail. Carvel, what have you got?
Yeah, I do have what is an unmitigated triumph, which is that my youngest, the 12-year-old Georgia, from the beginning of this year, she has been hinting in her slightly hinting, which means insisting and never letting it go, that she should be allowed to navigate her way all the way home from school to her new place over by the lake. The distance from her school to the lake is probably, as the crow flies, 2.5 miles, but it's too long to walk. It's probably like a 40-minute walk, given the way the streets go, and you have to walk around the lake. You can't walk across it, obviously. And then, you know, and then the bus situation is there's no direct bus. You have to take multiple buses. And I'm a little bit on the fence about her taking the bus at this age, and so on and so forth. And it's a lot of stuff. Anyway, she's been getting at it, hinting that she should be allowed to do it. And I've been stalling with, well, I'll talk to your mom. Your mom and I will talk about it, whatever. She's like, mom's okay with it. Mom thinks I should do it. I'm like, well, your mom and I will talk about it, which is dad code for I'm not okay. And I want to see if I can talk your mom out of being okay with this. In any event, her and her mom did discuss it. And she decided yesterday morning, she informed me in the car on the way to school that she was going to take the bus home, that she has figured it out. She's mapped it. She knows what it is. She's going to transfer here. This is you take this bus, then you transfer here, then you take the other bus, and then it drops you off by the tennis courts, and then you walk home. No problem, Dad. And I was like, okay, well, let's see what happens. And I was a little nervous, but she's done, this is like the second level of busing around. She's done other busing, but maybe through better neighborhoods, maybe more direct bus routes, maybe shorter rides. So she's kind of been working her way up to this. And she was the driver of this. We were not like, you need to take the bus home, because that would be easier for us. And she was resistant, and we were insisting, no, it's time you do this, which is the way some of these progresses happen. But this one, she's been pushing for it, the freedom to do this. And, I told her to call me when she got home, and yesterday I got a call that she was walking up the stairs from home and she had taken the bus all the way from her school to the house, and she was so proud of herself, and she made the transfer effectively, and the transfer was sketchy because, like, it's at this one kind of downtown city center area where there's like a bunch of bus stops all up and down the block, and you never know which one is the one that you're going to. And, you know, it's kind of complex, but she was able to do the whole thing, and she navigated it, and she is really feeling herself right now in her freedom. And I was, you know, I still don't love the idea, because I think the longer you take the bus around Oakland, the higher the likelihood of something happening that you don't want to be a part of, which is just my experience in the city. But that's also part of living in an urban area. And I grew up taking the bus around LA starting when I was about 14. And, you know, for the most part, I was able to steer clear of things, even if stuff happened on the bus. I was like, I'll just sit back here. I hope the police handle this. And she feels 100% confident. And I am supporting her and I'm happy for her. And I just feel so good that she was able to pull this off. And most importantly, she feels so good. And I can just see the world opening up for her as she begins to realize that she can get herself around. So that's her triumph. And therefore, it is mine.
Have you had a talk with her about, like, this is some of the stuff that has happened on buses that I've been on, and here's a good way to deal with that?
Yes. Her threat level remains fairly high, but just constitutionally. So these aren't topics that we have to introduce her to. She typically introduces them to us. And, you know, we had another parent who was another friend of mine, a parenting friend whose kids were much older. And at one point I remember him bringing this up. This is when my kids were like in kindergarten-ish. And then his kids were just at that taking the bus age. And he had three kids, a son, an older son, and two daughters. And he talked a lot about how his daughter was pushing to take the bus. And he didn't want her to take the bus. And he was really concerned and back and forth. And then he started to really question his motives because he was like, I certainly would have let, like, Dylan, the son, take the bus at this age, and why am I so concerned about her? And, like, is that unfair? Because that was something that his daughter brought up. Like, well, Dylan took the bus when he was in ninth grade or eighth grade or seventh grade or whatever, and why didn't you stop him? And it was interesting watching him go through that. At the time, it went in one ear and out the other, but I found myself reflecting on it again this time around because I was like, am I more concerned for her because she's a girl? Am I more concerned about that sort of thing? And is, like, what of this is, like, legitimate parental concern and awareness of potential things? And what of this is me kind of like, what's the right word here? Me sort of overly imbuing my daughter with this preciousness to where the world can't touch her and she can't be involved in the world and I'm not comfortable with that. Like, which of my response to this is this? And so in that's one of the reasons why I like to let her mother take the lead on things like this, because I feel like she has a much more nuanced and complex understanding of what it means to be a girl growing up and navigating the world. And because her mother was like, yeah, I think this is the right time for this. I think I know my daughter. I know Oakland. I know these cities. I know these streets. I know what happens to girls. I know how girls do with the world. I think this is okay. So that's a long way of saying, yes, not only have we had that talk, we've also had the talk around the talk and the talk around the talk around the talk. And I feel like there's still, with both the kids, because Ezra takes the bus too, and with both the kids, there is the possibility that they may see things. And I'm thinking particularly of fights, confrontations, which happen not infrequently in the after school hours in downtown Oakland. It's like you're going to see something. I think that, you know, I know that a lot of kids her age take the bus. Like when I'm on the bus, I notice a whole bunch of kids her age. So it's not some crazy thing like child, where is your mother kind of situation. So we've talked about all the stranger dangers, all the threats and everything. But in the end, the fact that she felt motivated to do it, even though she tends to be kind of a high anxiety, high threat level person, made me think she feels ready to do this. Let's let her do this.
Hey, I've got a question for you because a few weeks ago, my stepdaughter was here and she and I were just talking about something that I knew to be true without having to ask her, was just like the routine, super common sexual harassment that teenage girls get when they just walk around in the world, right?
Yeah.
And my husband was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, yeah, Lily, I'm sure you've been catcalled and whistled at. Or she's like, yeah, it happens all the time, like every single day. And she was super casual about it. And my husband was like blown away. And I remember walking to school, like in, you know, late grade school, junior high, high school, this always happening. And just it like the whole, you talk about her being a high threat kid. Does she talk to you about that kind of stuff happening? Because I just assume that it happens to girls. And I don't know how many of them also just assume that it happens and fold it into their landscape. Or does she respond when that kind of stuff happens?
I never fully know, because one of the things that if you're a wise parent, you assume that what your kid is telling you is only anywhere between 30 to 50% of the story. You know what I mean? Because kids do especially around this age, begin to operate a life in secret. That's part of how they grow away from you. And it's part of just what they do. And so I assume that there's more happening than she's told me about. But she has talked to me about sexual harassment experiences that she's had, both online and in person. And usually from people her own age, like this boy at school said this and this boy, I heard this boy at school say this to this girl and what's up and that's fucked up, you know, and that kind of thing. And I know that her and her friends talk about it a lot. It's one of the reasons why I'm really, really, really supportive of the incredible closeness she has with her peers, which is all sort of a core group of four or five girls who are always together, because this is something that they talk about a lot and support each other with a lot. And they're all right now they're, you know, they're all 12, and I really like her having that support. I know that she and her mother talk about it much more in a different way than she and I do. As a father, I consider my primary role in this situation to be something a little bit more atmospheric, which is that it seems to me that in order for a girl to grow up and navigate the world, she has to feel empowered to say she has to feel empowered to say no. She has to feel empowered to stand up for what she believes in. She has to feel that it isn't mandatory for her to please or placate or ameliorate people who violate her boundaries. And it seems to me, and this is something that I've kind of arrived at after talking with her and her mother a lot about these issues. It seems to me that part of my job as a father is to make sure that she has the space to do that she knows how to do that, that she has a lot of practice doing that, and that she feels entirely safe doing that with me. And so I feel a lot of my parenting around this issue isn't the direct kind of on the nose, like if someone says something like this, do you say this? Because she gets a lot of that growing up in if you're a girl in the Bay Area in 2017, you have learned a lot about street harassment, about feminism, about personal space, about boundaries. So all of that on the nose stuff, she already knows the information. What I'm most interested in is, like, does she have a relationship to the world and a relationship to her own power that allows her to act on that knowledge? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And so, so the two things that I do is that I try to, like, let her, I try to always look for opportunities where I get to tell her or let her experience, like, setting boundaries and having them respected so that she knows that that's actually what it's supposed to be like. And the other thing I do is I really let her mother take the lead on this, because I recognize that her mother has a host of experiences, kind of like what you're saying about Kevin, like that she, her mother and her and all her friends and all the girls that she knows and all the women in my life have a host of experiences that I will never fully know. And they've been having those experiences for way longer than we think. And this is, I don't want to end on this because this is kind of creepy, but the first time she told me about feeling creepy about a guy, she was in elementary school.
Yeah.
And she told me that her and her friend, that there was this guy that was like hanging out outside the gate looking at them and that it made them feel super creepy. And that was like third or fourth grade. So my assumption is that it begins then.
That's about right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well,
sorry, Gabe. No.
Well, congratulations on her taking the bus anyway. I think it's great that she wants to. No, it really is. Yeah. It's great that she wants to. It sounds like she's got her shit together. So good for you.
Yeah.
Good for her.
She really does.
And
and
also, if this is the world that we live in and that she's growing up in and that you're raising her in, which unfortunately it is, then like at some point she has to take the bus. And like, she's going to encounter this stuff, and you can't lock her away from it, and she needs to know how to deal with it and know that she has support when she deals with it, but she still also has to get from place to place.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what my point is there. Just
don't have kids is what we're saying.
It's a very
welcome
sad.
To Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Our advice is never have children.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Our advice is we all live in a fallen world, and it's best to acknowledge the tragic nature of existence, especially for women and girls, and to do your parenting and your child raising in light of that tragic nature. That, I guess, that is my advice. There we go. I have a fail, and it's much smaller scale than that, except it sort of isn't. So regular listeners to the program will have heard me talk about my younger and more athletic brother, who is a beloved uncle to my children. And over the past couple of weeks, my younger and more athletic brother suffered a health condition and wound up going into the hospital and having surgery. I should say he is fine now. He's recovering from surgery. We're hoping that he will be out of the hospital today. But last week, before the surgery had taken place, you know, everyone expected the surgery to go fine, but there's a sort of atmosphere of worry and concern around their uncle being in the hospital, and is he going to be okay, and what are the doctors going to do, and the grown-ups are all seeming a little worried, and, you know, both my wife and I went to the hospital on different evenings to visit him, and so, you know, where's Dad? He's at the hospital visiting your uncle, like that. And, of course, the kids then are concerned about him and are hoping that he's going to be okay and are expressing concern. And we try to reassure them, and they want to do something to express their concern. And so they do the time-honored childhood expression of concern, which is to make him a card. So they each make him a card, and Eliza can write a kind message and draw a picture, and Leo can, you know, use his crayons and scribble all over a piece of paper and, look, I made this great card. Oh, it's so beautiful. And so they do that, and they present me with these cards for him, and then I go off to the hospital. And then the next day I come back, or, you know, I came back that night, but they're in bed. And then the next day at breakfast, I say, so I went and saw your uncle, and he's doing just great, and he sends you his love. And they say, why are the cards still right here on the table? And, you know, that was an unfortunate oversight. And I will use the excuse that my concern was elsewhere, but it would have been nicer for the kids to know that their messages of concern and love and sympathy were actually being delivered to their uncle rather than just Dad leaving them on the kitchen table. So that is my fail for the week.
Yeah.
The car didn't go anywhere. It's not like you set them on fire. You can always get them to them later.
I took them the next time. It's just, it makes it too clear how much of a sham it is, the whole making a card process.
Yeah,
like, oh, he's going to love these cards. Well, if he was really going to love them, maybe I would have remembered to take them. You know what I mean? It just exposes the extent to which you're bullshitting them the whole time. That's the real failure.
It's busy work.
It's busy work. That's exactly
busy
it.
Work, yeah.
That's the real failure.
Shut up and color. Daddy's got something to do in the kitchen.
Yeah, you're just not supposed to let them know. Oh, well.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hi, it's Gabe Carvel and Rebecca, and it's pledge season here on Slate Podcasts. We want to help you support this show and other Slate podcasts by joining Slate Plus, which you can do at slate.com/momanddadplus. We are breaking into this podcast just as we have been on all the other podcasts because some of you, if you're hearing this message, you are not yet a member of Slate Plus. Slate Plus members, of course, get their podcasts without ads, so they get them without these pledge drive segments as well. But if you're hearing us, that means you haven't joined Slate Plus, and we want to urge you to do that so that we can continue to make these shows that you enjoy and listen to. Rebecca, you come from a public radio background, so
yep.
Pledge drives are not new to you.
Pledge drives are my jam, Gabe. And I think that the most important thing when you're doing a pledge drive and you're talking about why people should do the thing you want them to do, in this case, going to slate.com/momanddadplus, the most important thing to do is tell people what they will get. If they do that, of course, they get the warm and fuzzy feeling for supporting a tremendous organization that creates high quality journalism that they rely on now more than ever. But most important, our listeners get to join like a special club of Slate Plus members who get extra content, extra ad-free podcasts delivered right to the podcast app of their choice, which is my favorite part of being a Slate Plus member. It comes right to my iTunes app. I don't have to do anything. I just get it. And they get to be kind of a part of a special club, Slate listeners who care about what it is they're getting. That's the most effective way, I think, to convey the message. But as a little closing point, we should point out there is a contest going on between all the podcasts at Slate about who can sign up the most Slate Plus club members. And I'm competitive and I really want to win this damn contest. So please go to slate.com/momanddadplus. Join Slate Plus right now if you're thinking about doing it, because I'm competitive and I want to win. Right? Isn't that how it's supposed to go?
Yeah, not out here in California, Rebecca. I am someone, as you know, who loves everyone equally and believes that we should all get along. It's just that there are certain Slate podcasts that I would like to destroy in this contest.
And you don't honor them?
They'll remain
nameless,
but let's just say that there are personal issues at stake. No, I do think that Slate, the thing about Slate Plus that I like, when I finally signed up for it a couple of weeks into doing this podcast, is the getting it delivered like directly to my podcast app without ads is actually incredible. And the other thing that is like, I feel like really motivated me was that this is a time in which the kind of reporting that Slate does is really, 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 really important. Mm-hmm. Like it's really important. And the way journalism works and the way that the stuff that people are doing on these other podcasts, even ones that are, you know, we love our podcast. It's about parenting. There are also podcasts that are about politics, that are about culture, that are about things that are happening. And the people who work here are incredibly smart and incredibly good at what they do. And I just continue to be more and more impressed every time I like listen to any other Slate podcast. And this is how these podcasts come to be. This is how this journalism work is done, is by people signing up for Slate Plus and supporting when they can and how they can. Like, that's what's needed right now. So if you at all care about good writing, good journalism, good research, good reporting, what it takes to go through like 50,000 documents of like a Freedom of Information Act thing and find the one thing that you need in order to complete the story, that's what Slate does. That's what this supports. I think it's tremendous.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Again, that URL is slate.com/momanddadplus. Sign up for Slate Plus so you can support Slate and we can win the contest. Back to the show. We have a call now from a listener named Malia.
Hi, my name is Malia. My family moved to a small community on an island in the Northwest a little over a year ago, and my husband works full-time here, and I mostly stay home with our daughter, who is almost two. As I imagine is common for a lot of stay-at-home parents, I find that one of the best ways for breaking up the monotony and isolation of full-time parenting is by having play dates and befriending other parents. And I've made a few other mom friends since we moved here, but since the population of the island is small, it's a small pool to fish in, and I only have about three or four other moms that I've connected with. And unfortunately, my closest new friend's child does not play well with my child. Her daughter is 2.5 and is really intense, and for some reason that isn't clear to me or the other mom, my daughter seems to trigger her daughter's intensity. Whenever we get together for a play date, inevitably within 20 minutes there's screaming and pushing and a meltdown. And my daughter handles it really well and doesn't seem to take it personally or hold it against the other girl. She always asks to go to her house and clearly considers her a friend as much as a 22-month-old can, I think. So I have a couple of questions about this situation. First and foremost, I'm just wondering if I'm doing my daughter a disservice by identifying this kid as her friend and by putting her in situations where she has to play with her. Am I sending a bad message about how friends should treat each other? I really like getting together with this other mom, and I would be sad to pause the friendship, but I obviously don't want to be doing something that is straight up bad for my kid. Also, I do feel like the other mom could be doing more to address her daughter's behavior, but I don't know exactly what she should do because it's not my kid and her daughter is really intense, like, all the time. So I don't know how much change can be expected, but I'm wondering if it's crossing the line to even ask the other mom to do more to address her kid's behavior. So I'd love to hear what experience you guys have had with this kind of situation, and what you would do. So thanks for taking my call, and I love the show. Bye.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Malia. What do you think, Carvel?
I think that it's interesting the repeated use of the word intense. I wonder what that means. And obviously the slight, the kind of like slight diss of the other mom, which I'm sure wasn't like malicious, but it's the kind of thing that we as parents tend to do. Like, well, I feel like the other parent should be doing more to manage this. That's all within the context that this doesn't sound to me like something that anything has to be done about over the long term, because my experience is that she talked about having only been there for a certain period of time. This is a new and burgeoning relationship. I can think of a number of interactions that when my kids were two, it seemed like they just personality clash with this other two-year-old. Like, I don't know what it is, but it's just a mess. We can't ever get together, blah, blah, blah. And now, I mean, over the ensuing years, so many dynamics have unfolded in those relationships where everyone's fine. And I suspect that within another 3 months, these kids will be happily playing together all the time. It's a little bit like, forgive me for the analogy, but it's a little bit like when you have one cat and you bring another cat into the house. And then for the first 3 months, they're hissing at each other. And then one of them won't allow the other one to get on the bed. And it's all kinds of weird shit. And then you come by 6 months later and they're snuggled up in the corner, you know, holding a stuffed animal. Like, and I think that that's what happens with a lot of kids. Kids get used to each other. They're also very territorial. They also trigger each other in weird ways, especially at that two-year-old age. As they both grow and develop and become used to each other, I think that you'll find that they get along a lot smoother. There's plenty over the hill in this relationship, I guess, is the message I would give. And the caller is right that it is really important to have play dates and to break up the monotony, especially if you're living in a kind of isolated place where you can't just sort of walk out your front door and immediately be surrounded by stores and bookstores and libraries and people and parks. So I would say probably just relax a little bit, let the kids work it out. Definitely some crying happens. I find what we found in a more practical basis is that certain kids that where beef would jump off between the kids within 20 minutes, you know, they'd be playing, then one of them would come running, they'd be crying, and then I would sort of like take the one up, put it on my lap, hey, let's look at this book, and then we look at the book, and then just kind of like keep doing that, and then they would drift off back into play land after another 15 minutes. And then that was the way we navigated our way through the play date. Those first play dates weren't what I envisioned of a play date. It wasn't scintillating adult conversation while the kids entertained themselves in another room. But it took us a while, but eventually we did get there because the kids got used to each other. So that's what it sounds like to me this is.
Yeah, it seems like the big issue is how the caller's daughter is responding to the other kid's intensity. And from what I took from the call, the caller's daughter is fine. That kid like is pretty chill about having a playmate who throws these fits and tantrums and gets super upset. And as long as your own kid like is comfortable with this other kid acting like doing what sounds like pretty typical 2-year-old behavior, then I don't think you need to worry that you're sending the wrong message. Like, of course, you don't want to hang out with a 2-year-old who's throwing a tantrum. Of course, that's not an appropriate friend for you, an adult. But your daughter is like, well, it's a play date. And sometimes when you're with another kid, that kid will like scream their head off. And that's just what happens. Like, if the other kid is being physically violent and you're worried they're going to hurt your kid, then you have to do something to keep them separate. But unless your kid is bothered by all of this intensity, then I don't think you need to worry about the effects on her.
I totally agree. My best friend today is a friend I made in a playgroup when our kids were 6 months old. My first son was 6 months old. And both of our babies, frankly, I don't think I've talked about this much in the show, but Henry sucked when he was a baby. Like, he was just a very unsatisfying baby to have in like a lot of ways. Like, he was stiff. He didn't like being held. He cried all the time, threw up constantly. Like, he was not affectionate. And my friend Amy, who I'm still best friends with today.
It's like you're describing a
turtle. Yeah. She also had a baby who totally sucked, a girl, Jaden, who screamed constantly. That they are both the two most intense, like, unpleasant two-year-olds you could possibly imagine. From the time
so
they were,
you
like,
bonded
baby, 6 months
over having,
old.
You bonded over, well, having, like, the reject babies.
Well, we just really liked each other, right? So
right.
And that's what it sounds like this situation is. Like, we just wanted to hang out together because we could not just, it wasn't just about having, you know, babies who were, like, unsatisfying to have, frankly. It was about, we really bonded and we actually liked each other and we got along really well. And so we would just, we learned that when we got our kids together, after about 20 minutes, there'd be a disaster. Her kid would be screaming. Mine would then hide and not talk for an hour. And we kind of just learned, like, what are we going to do about this, right? It was not like about her kid or my kid. It's like, we're friends. What are we going to do about it? And fast forward even like a year, like when they were 3 or 4, both of these kids like started turning into like super lovely kids. And now they're like the mellowest teenage kids you could possibly imagine. So I don't think you're teaching your kids stuff a lot about real relationships when they're not even 2 years old yet, because frankly, some babies, frankly, some suck. I mean, mine did. So I'm very comfortable saying that, you know, even if your good friend's daughter kind of sucks right now, like, don't hold it against the friendship. Maintain the friendship and let this stuff shake out, because it probably will.
Okay, what about the second part of the mother's question? Should she say something to the other mother about her toddler's intense behavior?
I mean, you kind of jumped at what I was going to say, which is that other thing that did jump out to me was the kind of like, I feel like the mother should be dealing with this differently. And I hate to say the same thing again, but I also think that is one of those when you're a young parent and you really believe that other parents should be doing stuff precisely as you envision they should. And it's, I would say that that's also something to probably let go. I mean, I think the mother knows that her daughter's behavior is kind of intense. Probably the mother of the other child is like secretly dying inside and totally mortified every time this happens, because I also had, God bless Ezra, but I don't even know if he was a difficult baby, but I know that when he was in groups, even as early as 18 months old, invariably he would seem to be the one causing everyone else suffering and emotional bloodshed. I don't know how he did it, but that just seemed to be the vibe whenever we like would get a bunch of kids together or have like a babysitting co-op. It would always be like a bunch of kids would be playing, then all of a sudden everyone would be like, Ezra did the thing. Ezra, blah, blah, blah. And it was just like, it was mortifying. I hated it so much. It just drove me crazy. And so I'm sure this mother is dying inside. She knows that her daughter is intense. That's not something you miss as a parent. And what I think happens a lot of times when we have little kids is we overestimate the extent to which we have control over their behavior. And we also overestimate, consequently, the extent to which other parents have control over their kids' behavior. So when our kids happen to be acting awesome, we think that that's all because of us. Newsflash, it's not really. And when other kids' parents, when other little toddlers are acting shitty, we think that's because of the parents. Newsflash, it's not. There are way many more factors. So if you want to keep a friendship going with this person, I think that you need to be a little bit more accepting, or not more, but I think you need to be accepting of the person's parenting as much as you can be, because acceptance and safety and trust is the basis of a good friendship. And it sounds like a friendship is what's needed here and is what you want to form and is what you have. So I wouldn't say too many shitty things about the person's parenting if I could avoid it. At the very least, because this mother probably already feels pretty bad about it.
The one thing that you could maybe say, depending on how defensive you think the other mom actually internally feels about it, you could conceivably say, hey, whenever we get these kids together, there's always a sort of explosion, and maybe we could strategize together about what we could do to structure things so that it doesn't go off like this. And make it, like, talk about it in terms of the dynamic between the two kids and the two parents and what everybody should be doing. But you can't do that if, like, it's actually secretly what you're saying is you should discipline your child more or something like that. Like, you can only say it if you really want to open up a potentially collaborative conversation about how to act in that situation. And if you can't do that, then I agree with Carvel. You should probably just let it go.
Yes, that's well said.
Yep, agreed.
All right.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambi Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's move on. We have another call today, this one from Celeste.
Hi, this is Celeste. I'm calling for Mom and Dad Are Fighting. I'm a stepmother of two adult 30-something sons. I'm in my early 50s. My husband is mid-60s and retired at the end of last year. Here's my issue. One of my stepsons is doing well professionally, but the other has always been marginally employed, and my husband subsidizes him, as does his mother. We've been married for 10 years and have a joint household account to which we contribute equally, but we keep the rest of our money and our spending separate, so I've had no insight into what he gives his son. He pays it from his own account. I recently overheard him complaining to a friend on the phone that he was broke. And that surprised me. I know his income has decreased, but I know that he shouldn't be in any kind of dire financial situation. So when I asked about it, he said that he's been giving his son $1,000 a month, which floored me. I'm still working, so I suppose I could contribute more to our household account, but I think this is kind of ridiculous. And I think I would resent having to give more to our household account so he can support another household. So here's my dilemma. I think this needs to stop, and I said so to my husband. I think that if his son is struggling, then, you know, we can invite him over, discuss it, and I'm even open to him moving in with us. We have an extra room until he gets on his feet. But I don't think he should be paying this, and I'm just not quite sure, as a step-parent, if I have a right to do this. My husband thinks inviting him over to talk about it would embarrass him. I don't have any kids of my own, but I really don't think if I did that I'd be paying their rent. So just wondering if you guys have any thoughts about this. I haven't heard a lot of stories on your podcast about adult step-parenting issues, so I'd love to know your thoughts. Thanks.
Rebecca, is this a question about step-parenting or is this a question about marriage?
It's a question about both things, but it also, I think, speaks more to the parenting, step-parenting thing. It sounds like they have a really nice, somewhat separate financial arrangement in their marriage. I would never in a million years judge how anybody structures their marriage financially. I've been in two marriages. I'm in my second marriage. They were structured very different financially. Right now, I'm in the model where literally everything goes into a giant pile, not so giant pile, but a pile. And, you know, we just deal with it from there. But my first marriage was much more structured, more along the lines of what this caller is talking about. Both worked fine for various reasons. You know, I could make easily the case that in my new situation, it's better for a variety of reasons, but that also has more to do with the marriage being better in a lot of ways. But when it comes to step-parenting of adult children, I'm actually, in my family, there's a similar situation going on right now with a different outcome. One of my siblings is having a really hard time right now, and has asked my parents for help, and one parent has been helpful and the other one has not. The one that has not been helpful is definitely being influenced by the marriage that they're in and some of the dynamics there. And there's other issues too. But ultimately, what it comes down to is that this parent has actually never been particularly supportive or generous. And it's just very easy to sort of put it on the step parent and say, this is why this parent's not really being helpful when the other parent has really stepped up in this crisis situation, because, you know, they're being influenced by this other person. But really, if you look at the long history of our lives, like there's a like pattern of nurturing with each parent that is present with one and not the other. So
that was heck of a subtweet in the middle
I know,
an answer to
I understand, but this is my point, is that your husband, this is what I would say to this caller, your husband is a generous guy who probably gets a lot of pleasure or at least feels, you know, like he's being a good parent by supporting his son. We can all sit here and say that a son who's the age of his son should maybe do this or maybe do that, or this is what he wants to do, and he's not doing it with your money because your financial situation has made it in your marriage that he has his own money and you have yours. I think my opinion is the relationship between him and his son is their relationship, and it should remain intact. And if there are things about parenting choices that he wants to make, even with his adult child, that's kind of his call. That's my opinion. I think it is my one less nurturing parents. It's their business if they don't want to be helpful. It's the other nurturing parent's business if she wants to be helpful. Oop, I just gave it away. Sorry. That's okay. It's fine. Neither one of them knows how to listen to a podcast, so it's fine. But yeah, I don't think it's for this caller to say. If her husband is to some extent fine with not having a lot of pocket money or spending money because he's doing this help for his son, then that's the situation he's chosen, and he's clearly getting something out of it. I mean, if she were saying we don't have any, you know, retirement savings because he's helping his son, if somebody hurting her other than the fact that she knows he's complaining he's broke, then it's a larger conversation. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's different when stepkids are adults than it is when stepkids are little. It's kind of the primary relationship should be, the final call should be with the parent and their child when it comes to situations around support and money, especially when it's not having a negative impact on the household at large in terms of savings and income and so forth. So yeah, I'd say back off of this one. That would be my call.
Here's where I disagree with you, I think. I disagree that it's possible, regardless of what kind of sort of objective arrangement or structure you've put in place to keep your financial affairs separate. I think it's impossible to actually keep your money separate if you're married. I mean, of course, you can have separate bank accounts and you can make separate decisions. But even if, like, you both contribute the requisite amount, and so here's the joint account, and that covers our joint household expenses, I don't think you can say, and then all of the other financial decisions are just mine to do what I want with, and your money is yours to do what you want with. Because when you are married to someone, live with someone, have a life with somebody, then those decisions affect one another.
And you're right.
And at the same time, I completely agree that the parent-child relationship has to some degree be kept intact and maintain its integrity separate from the relationship with the step-parent. So there's two important things that are coming into conflict here, right? The father's relationship with his son, which is his own, and the father's relationship with his money, in which the wife, I think, has a reasonable claim to have some say. And so I don't think this is something that can just – I don't think this is something where the wife just has to sit there and sort of take it. I think if she thinks there's more to discuss here, if she wants to, like – I mean, I don't know if bringing the son in and having a three-way conversation is necessarily the right way to go. That might
– It's not.
Not be right. No, it probably isn't. It probably isn't. But I think the husband and wife have a lot more talking to do about this.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that.
Yeah, tie break point, Rebecca.
Damn,
you're real, you're wrong. no, I tend to agree 100% with Rebecca on this. I actually do think, even though it's not, I mean, I understand your point, Gabe, that it's hard to say what you do with your personal finances don't matter to me as your life partner, as long as they don't affect us paying the bills. I mean, because if you're broke, that it somehow impacts me. Like if I'm like, let's go to Cancun, and you're like, well, I can't because I'm broke. And I'm like, well, you wouldn't be broke if you didn't give all your money to this shiftless child of yours. That I can see how that makes sense. However, good fences make good neighbors, and boundaries are really important in relationships, in my experience. And the slow erosion of boundaries over time is actually, I have found in my experience, to be a pretty poisonous factor in a long-term, loving, cohabitating relationship. And these people have separate bank accounts for a reason. There's a joint account for joint expenses, but they operate their lives separately. I think that just like it is not, it's, this person may have an opinion about it, and I would have an opinion about it too, but having an opinion is different than having it be your actual business. I mean, you can have a thought without it being your actual business. And I actually think that the way this father chooses to interact with his adult child is not really the other person's business. Even though I too would be like, I think to myself, this guy's maybe doing a little more handholding than needs to be done. That's immaterial. The point is that this is his child and this is the decision he's making. I think as a friend, you can talk through it with him. He can talk through it. You can help him talk through it. You can wonder about it. But I don't think it's within anyone's rights to say, this is what you should be doing with your kid. And I don't like that you're doing this. I think that is a violation of a certain kind of boundary sovereignty. And I think that actually ends up, my experience has been that causes more damage than it repairs. I also think with the finances, the same thing is true, that you would not like your partner to do things that would put them in financially difficult situations. But if it is their money, it is actually, and I mean truly mean, it is not your business. And I know that's hard. I know that's really unusual. I know that's not typically how we operate, but I actually think that that's the way it is. And I think that healthy relationships and healthy boundaries come from holding those kinds of things. So I sympathize very much with the caller. I understand it's very difficult. I think the caller should talk to as many people as they can about it. I think the caller should vent with other people their frustration, explore their own feelings. But I think that the caller, for the sake of their marriage, must recognize that there are certain boundaries up and that she probably shouldn't cross them. Because it leads to much, in my experience, much greater difficulties in the long run.
Now, the caller and her husband are in a tiny boat, and the husband's side of the boat is taking on water, taking on water. And the caller is in that boat, too. And you can't just say, oh, well, your side of the boat is your business. You can't do that, or you go down together.
But that's a marriage problem. And what you're talking about, and actually Carvel gave an example that speaks to that. And this isn't explicitly what the caller said. But if the situation is that one of them can afford to go to Cancun and the other one can't go, then that's kind of a messed up way to manage your joint money. Like, is your joint money for things for both of you? Is it literally just to pay the mortgage and then like one of you is going to be able to go on vacation or not? Or is it like all of the joint goal stuff is together and then, you know, we each also have this pile that we can save, that we can invest or that we can spend or that we can whatever, but the household and the couple stuff is in the middle. That's what it sounded like to me.
So you're saying Cancun is in the middle. Cancun comes out of the joint account.
The husband is complaining about being broke.
He's complaining about being broke. That's not a guy who's like about to go to Cancun.
Maybe what he means is he can't go out with his friends to the steakhouse. You know what I mean? Yeah. Maybe it means that he can't go to buy a new pair of shoes and he's got to bring his old shoes to the cobbler again. We don't know what broke actually means. Yeah. It sounds like these guys, yes. I don't know. I mean, she can't go to the haberdasher. We have cobblers here, dude. Come on.
I will stipulate that if the joint account is sufficiently flush that they're going off to Cancun together and that the sacrifices that the husband was complaining about are all to do with his sort of personal guy time recreational decisions and perhaps footwear, I will stipulate that in that case, no, then the wife is not actually experiencing any jeopardy or any problems, and so she shouldn't really intervene.
Here's a really good reason why why this boundary is in place. Because let's say that this boundary between the step-parent and the parent and the child is no longer in place, and the father wants to do this thing, and then the stepmother is like, no, it has to be this way. It should be this way. I really feel this strongly. And the father says, you sure? Stepmother says, yes, this is the way it has to be. So then the father then goes ahead and does whatever it is that the stepmother feels like should be right. Okay, I will see. And then does it. And then it somehow goes wrong. It doesn't work out. It becomes bad. Now it's no longer about the relationship between the father and son. It's now the relationship between the husband and wife that is now in jeopardy because this thing didn't work out well with the son, and so on and so forth. And like now this relationship between the son and the stepmother is like strained. And the whole thing, when you intervene in people's lives in areas that aren't your business, you make the event about you versus them rather than the event at hand. And that always comes back to bite you in the ass. It just does. And that's one of the reasons. And I'm also saying this knowing that this is not the way most of us operate our interpersonal relationships. I think in general, we have far too much belief in the nature of familiarity and that it's all – and the boundaries are fluid and we're all just one and everything's flowing into each other. And I think we overdo that as a culture. And I think actually this is a situation where there are actually pretty clear boundaries. And I think these are them.
All right. Tough question, Celeste. Tough situation. Let us know how it goes and whose advice you chose to take, because, of course, that's what's really important here.
Wait, can I just say one other thing?
Yeah, go.
Before she overheard this conversation, she didn't know her husband was giving
that's
away
$1,000
to his son,
boom,
right?
Boom, Gabe.
But that
so
should,
I think
that,
that
should
just
be
by
fine.
Default,
by you
but
guys,
by default,
that should
then
be fine.
We know. Yeah, that's the whole point, is it is fine because she didn't know. So clearly
it's not
it can't
impacting
be
her.
Having that
it
much
It can't
of
be having
impact.
An impact on her. She didn't even know.
I mean, yes.
Boom. Hold on. Incoming
we
message
win,
for
Carvel.
Gabe. Oh, it says boom.
We're going to cut this part. We're going to cut this part where they're making fun
we
of me.
We
will cutting
do no
it.
Such thing.
Cutting it out. Maybe it could be maybe plus only. Time now for recommendations. Rebecca, what are you going to recommend?
I actually have an anti-recommendation this week, and that is do not watch the HBO series The Deuce while your children are home and there's any chance that they could be awake and wander into the living room during a scene in which Maggie Gyllenhaal is giving a 16-year-old boy his first BJ as a birthday gift.
Whoa.
It's not a conversation you want to have. So,
to be fair, it was a very brief scene.
Sure, it was a brief scene, but just do yourself a favor. Make sure that either the kids aren't home or that they are definitely sleeping when you watch the HBO series The Deuce, because my recommendation would be that you do not actually want to have the awkward laughter and all of the stuff that will happen when you're watching that scene and then turn around and realize that your teenage son has been standing behind you for God knows how long eating a bowl of ice cream. So do not watch HBO's The Deuce when your children could potentially be awake and on the hunt for a midnight snack. That's my advice, and that's my recommendation.
Great recommendation. Watch The Deuce alone.
You have saved many a life with that recommendation.
Carvel, what's your recommendation?
I'm recommending something that my rapidly intellectual son sent to me. First, I asked him for a recommendation on the way here, and the first thing he said was, this is my 14-year-old. He writes, how about Camus' take on the myth of Sisyphus? And I'm like,
Remember when you were a baby who sucked that beat up other babies? Yeah. And I was suggesting this.
Remember when you couldn't crawl? Yeah. I was like, yeah, I'm probably going to need something a little younger, LOL. But that's cool. I'm going to read that. And then he's like, well, honestly, it took me an hour to understand the first two pages. So, he's getting into, this is a whole side note. He's got this, finally got a teacher who will indulge his endless attempts to become a philosopher, and so he's really into it now. So what he then sent me was a link to a YouTube video of Vox Explainer, which he loves Vox Explainers, and this one is How the Mona Lisa Became So Overrated, and we're going to put the link on all the requisite pages, but How the Mona Lisa Became So Overrated, he sent me this with the commentary, I found this interesting. Hmm. And that's it. That's my 14-year-old. So that's my recommendation.
That's an awesome highbrow recommendation and then high middlebrow recommendation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Those are great recommendations. My recommendation is something super canonical that needs no recommendation, but Eliza has been reading the Fudge books by Judy Blume.
Yes.
And classic. I remember
yes.
those books so well. They're so great.
Oh, yes.
And the first one is Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, of course. The next one is otherwise known as Sheila the Great, which I didn't quite realize was a Fudge book, but which takes place in the Fudgeverse and has been sort of worked into the Fudge mythos. And
wait, Super Fudge is not the second one after Tales of Fourth Grade Nothing?
I would have said Super Fudge was the second one, but according to the way it's being published now, because now, you know, they have to brand everything as part of a series, even if they were written as discrete books with some of the same recurring characters.
I see.
So
I
now, if you look it up, then the one with the number 2 on the spine is otherwise known as Sheila the Great, and Super Fudge comes third. Otherwise known as Sheila the Great, it features Peter and Fudge in a sort of peripheral role, and the main character is their neighbor, Sheila, who it's another great book. I remember these books so vividly that when she started talking about them, I could, like, talk about the little details with her. And I had not read this book for, like, 30-plus years. It's really cool. These are great books. Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing and the other Fudge books by Judy Blume.
And, brings it back. I remember the vanilla pudding for dessert
right?
and eating the yes, it's really incredible. Nicely done.
One I was talking
about. The baby named Tootsie.
Yes, the house. Yeah. They go stay in an old house and the water comes out of separate faucets for hot and cold. Yeah, I remembered that so clearly.
Yeah.
Good job, Judy Blume.
And when Peter pees in the plant, that's in the Fourth Grade
Because he's been drinking the fruit punch.
Yes, this is so good. Oh man!
All right,
I guess the bigger question is we describe Baby Fudge as intense. I think we probably would, right.
Fudge was definitely intense.
Accurate.
If your kid is having a play date with Fudge, just let it play out. Fudge is basically a good kid.
It's gonna be fine.
And that's our show. If you have a question that you would like us to address, give us a call at 424-255-7833. Join the discussion about our show on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. This episode was produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie, I'm Gabriel Roth, and we'll be back next week.